journalist, consultant, or volunteer, Ray Argyle has observed many Canadian political campaigns. He's written about some of them and more in his new book, Turning Points, The Campaigns That Changed Canada. Argyle features 15 key elections from Confederation on, which he examines and offers some prescriptions that are in this book that's just been published by White Knight. The price is $29.95. Argyle is the founder of Argyle Rowland Worldwide, a Toronto-based consulting firm. Among the countless international corporations he has himself counseled, Ray has also advised heads of government like German Chancellor Ludwig Erhard and former President Gerald Ford. He's also counseled the great Sir Peter Ustinov and Jimmy Pattison. He's also a native of British Columbia. Welcome to the commentary.ca from Toronto, Ray Argyle. Good afternoon, Mr. Argyle.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Joseph.
What compelled you to call a listing of what are what you consider turning points in Canadian Confederation?
Because I'd been involved in a number of campaigns over the past 40 years, either as a journalist or as a strategist or a volunteer. And what I wanted to do with Turning Points was to go back and cover the decisive moments in our political history and try to provide some understanding of what we all need about these past campaigns in order to better deal with the political choices that are before us in Canada today. I also felt that Canadians do not have a proper appreciation of their history, and I hope that my book will contribute to overcoming that.
How long did it take you to research and write this book?
I researched the book over a 15-year period, really? But I actively did the writing over the past 2 years. And I commence with the 2004 election, which I use as a staging platform to examine the other key campaigns in Canadian political history, going right back to the tumultuous election of 1866 in New Brunswick, in the colony of New Brunswick, where money from the Secret Service Fund of Canada was used to bring about a favorable result for Confederation.
So you consider that significant in the book you write? Because if it hadn't been for that, there wouldn't have been a Confederation, right?
Well, indeed, and that's my next chapter after the 2004. We call that chapter the Confederation Conspiracy. Because, indeed, you see, New Brunswick at that time, being one of the key colonies that would have to come on board to bring about Confederation, had an anti-Confederation government. And what happened was that we saw a conspiracy between MacDonald in Ottawa, the British Colonial Office, and the British Governor General in New Brunswick to, frankly, use unconstitutional means to bring down that government and to force another election, which, when amply funded out of the Secret Service funds, brought about the desired result.
You also include, let's talk about just in general the 15 that you've chosen. Was it hard narrowing it down to 15? When you could have picked more?
Well, it was a challenge, and, you know, ideally, I think perhaps I would have wanted to deal with fewer elections, but these campaigns did emerge as I, you know, looked back over my own experience and then looked back into history and went into the archives to do my original and primary research. And what I found was that there were definitely moments in Canadian history where there were turning points that could have ended Confederation, that could have brought amalgamation with the United States, that could have maintained the colonial type of government that we'd known throughout the early parts of Canadian history. So having dealt with the New Brunswick election of 1866 that made Confederation possible, the next key turning point was the 1878 election where Sir John A. Macdonald brought in his national policy. That was his policy to erect a tariff wall around Canada to encourage the growth of Canadian industry. And of course, it had its downside because it meant that consumers had to pay more for their manufactured goods and was particularly unpopular in the West. By 1896, the era of conservative domination of post-Confederation politics had come to an end, and we had the election of Sir Wilfrid Laurier and the opening up of the West, and that was clearly a turning point. 1911, the first free trade election that led to the defeat of Laurier and wiped out free trade as an option for Canada for another three quarters of a century, that was a decisive moment in our history. When we got into the First World War, in the 1917 election, when the conservative government recruited many MPs from the liberal side to form a unionist coalition in support of conscription, was a turning point because it left a bitterly divided country and fundamentally destroyed the prospects of the Conservative Party in Quebec for many, many years to come.
Is that
so? Those are some of the early turning points that we faced.
Did you think that 1911 election was that sort of the beginning of where Quebec came into prominence, and whatever happened in Quebec influenced the direction or the
well, Quebec
the Canada?
Quebec was in prominence really from day one, from the beginning. After all, Confederation happened as a result of the cooperation between the Reform or Liberals in Upper Canada in Ontario and the Rouge elements in Quebec, and so MacDonald's Liberal Conservative Party, as he called it then, represented a really quite equitable balance of French and English interests in Canada. And so Quebec, from the beginning, as it remains today, is a part of the country where no party can govern without, you know, having substantial support from that party. In 1911, in the free trade election, the issue in Quebec was not so much free trade as it was Laurier's plan to build a Canadian Navy, and the nationalist elements in Quebec were very much opposed to that because they saw that as the invitation to participate in possibly in future British or European wars. So the nationalists of Quebec combined with the conservatives in the rest of Canada, who were bitterly opposed to free trade, and between them they were able to bring about the defeat of Laurier.
The four campaigns that you picked as having the largest impact on Canada, you've talked about 1878, 1896, and the other two are 1945 and 1988.
Indeed.
They have similarities amongst them, don't they?
Well, indeed. The 1945 election, the federal election of 1945, of course, came at the end of the Second World War. Came after a period in which there had been, first of all, the sufferings of the Depression and then the losses of the war. And Canadians were determined that they were going to have a brave new world and a better life after the war. The CCF, the predecessor of the NDP, had become very popular during the war years, and in fact at one point in the Gallup poll was leading both the Conservatives and the Liberals. And we see many instances of Mackenzie King's political brilliance throughout his career. At no time was that more dramatically demonstrated than in the 1945 election, when he not only accepted many of the platforms or planks being put forward by the CCF, but with a civil service that was looking to build a social welfare structure in Canada, accepted and went along with the pressures for social reform and created what I call a gentle revolution that brought in family allowances, unemployment insurance, enhanced old age pensions, and a whole variety of other social welfare structures that really created and built the kind of values that we have respected and indeed treasured in Canada ever since.
Do you suspect with a minority government now, with Paul Martin's minority government, that we could see the NDP possibly, like the CCF in the 1940s, have that influence again, or is that not possible?
Well, the problem is that we're not sure what, and I don't think the NDP is sure what their positions are on a number of issues and exactly what it is they want. Clearly, they'd love to have a proportional representation, which would give all of the smaller parties more seats in Parliament. But the advantage that Paul Martin has in the present time, and of course, he is merely looking for an opportunity to go back to the people and hopefully rebuild that majority that he had lost. The advantage he has is that he has three opposition parties, any one of which, give or take a seat or two, would sustain him in a close vote in Parliament. So I expect that this Parliament will last for some little while, but it will be dissolved, I think, at Paul Martin's behest rather than that of the opposition parties.
Well, we'll talk about current affairs in just a second, but I want to get back to the book. You don't only put national campaigns, but you include four provincial campaigns, the 1866 New Brunswick election, as well as the 1995 Quebec referendum. Now, those are, of course, great consequence to the nation. But the 1948 Newfoundland referendum and, of course, the 1952 British Columbia election, why did you include those two as well?
I thought that these elections were very important, not only regionally but nationally. First of all, the Newfoundland vote of 1948 essentially completed the work of Confederation. That was a great campaign. It was an exciting time when Joey Smallwood decided that he was going to support and work toward bringing Newfoundland into Confederation. It was a bitterly divisive contest, but one that truly, you know, you only have to look at the map to see that it has completed the work of Confederation. And so I felt that that election, as well as being an intensely interesting one, was one, or that referendum, was one that needed to be included in turning points. In the case of the 1952 British Columbia election, this was important because it represented the final desertion by Western voters of the old line parties, and really did affirm and lay the basis for alienation of the West toward Ottawa, toward the national political structure. And what we saw in 1952 was the old line parties, the Conservatives and the Liberals, having been discredited for their poor administration of the province, replaced not by the CCF, but by an upstart Social Credit Party, Social Credit in name only, by the way, but one that British Columbians saw as a preferred choice to anything that seemed to smack of Ottawa.
Now, one of the interesting things that I was reminded of, and I've read this in David Mitchell's book, but I was reminded again when I read your book last week, was that election in 52 could have gone either way. It could have gone to the Socreds, or it could have gone to the CCF.
Well, indeed, and under the old first-past-the-post voting system, it would have gone to the CCF. It was only because of a single transferable ballot that had been introduced in BC at that time that Social Credit was able to win. You see, the Conservatives and the Liberals both thought that if they brought in this single transferable ballot, that their supporters would vote one for the other as their second choice and make sure that it would keep out the CCF. Well, it did keep out the CCF, but of course what they didn't calculate on was this sudden arrival of Social Credit headed by Wacky Bennett. Now, by the way, the announcement this past weekend of the BC Citizens Assembly recommending a single transferable ballot sounds to me, and I haven't seen the documents in detail, but sounds to me like an attempt to bring back exactly that voting system. We need to realize, in looking at our history, and I was a journalist covering that campaign, that was a totally chaotic and disorganized method of voting. It took 3 weeks to decide who had won. It didn't deliver the government that had been supported by the majority of the people. So I would very much caution British Columbians before in considering whether they should return to that system.
I had Rafe Mayer on yesterday, and he was saying that, that he was in support of it, and the Green Party leader who was against it, and she was saying that, well, I guess she's just worried that you won't get very many Greens elected at all. Mm-hmm. Under the system as you would under proportional representation, I suppose. You, in the book you write that Trudeau is the greatest prime minister. Why?
I ranked the prime ministers in the order of the what I felt was their long-term impact on the country. And in Turning Points, I've recognized Prime Minister Trudeau for his tremendous accomplishment of creating, repatriating the Constitution, and of course establishing the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which has enacted into law the concept that the individual is supreme to the government. I feel that on the basis of those accomplishments, that Mr. Trudeau has to rank as our the outstanding Prime Minister, certainly of the 20th century. We also have to recognize, of course, as I've mentioned already, Mackenzie King's achievements, certainly Wilfrid Laurier, and of course we need to thank John A. Macdonald for being there in the beginning.
Ray Argyle is on the line. He's the author of the new book, Turning Points, The Campaigns That Changed Canada 2004 and Before, $29.95, published by White Knight Publications. You include the 2004 campaign. Why was it included, and do you think that in the grand scheme of history that it will remain one of the elections of great consequence to the country?
At this point, the 2004 election, I think, does deserve recognition as a turning point because it brought to an end the Liberal monopoly on national politics. We now have a vigorous opposition, of course, an opposition larger than the Liberal Party in Parliament. So I think it is an important election, measured on a short-term basis. Whether in the longer term it will remain a turning point remains to be seen.
One of the things I liked about this book is this is probably the first book out there that has an overview of the 2004 campaign, and so I enjoyed reading it again. And I forget just how many conservative outbursts there were from people like Cheryl Gallant and Scott Reed and Randy White. And I also forgot about Jean Lapierre and his running the election campaign in Quebec. Do you think that his efforts caused the election, or was that sponsorship?
Oh, I think that the sponsorship issue was of course the overriding factor. I don't say this in the book, but in reflecting since on the 2004 election, I would describe that election as a football game in which the Liberals fumbled their way through the first three quarters, but won it in the last quarter on pass interceptions. And immediately after the debate, all the polls were certainly indicating that Stephen Harper was on his way to at least a minority government. Then, of course, the old reform skeletons began to rattle out of the closet and indeed created a tremendous apprehension among so many voters and pushed them back to the Liberals despite apprehensions about sponsorship scandals and arrogance and so forth.
The Liberal showing in Ontario, was that strong? They lost a number of seats. Was that because of a reaction against the McGuinty budget?
I think there's some argument to be made for that. And in fact, in Turning Points, I describe the introduction of the of the McGuinty budget and the imposition of the health premium as a very key element in further upsetting voters in Ontario. And of course, who else could they take it out on but the federal Liberal candidates who were knocking on the door? Despite that, the federal Liberals held the majority of the seats in Ontario, and of course this was where the Conservatives had to break through. Their own polls showed them winning 20 seats that they ultimately lost on voting day. So it was a close call. As I say, it ended the monopoly on federal politics that the Liberals had enjoyed, but fell short because of the continued apprehension of many voters have for the right-wing views of some of the conservative candidates.
What do you think Paul Martin has to do so that he doesn't end up a prime minister of mediocrity?
Yes, I use that term and suggest that that could well be a fate. I think he has to do a couple of things. He has to avoid the temptation to go on a spending spree, and I think that so far he's not shown much ability to restrain himself. The other thing that he has to do is avoid and get away from this whole idea of asymmetrical federalism, a term that is a ghastly term that nobody really understands what it means, but what it means is uneven and unequal federalism. And he's got to get away from that, and neither of the party leaders can afford to play footsie with the sovereignist forces in Quebec. If they try to do that, they think they'll maybe make some short-term gains. But Canadians across the country, in election after election, going back through every election in the 20th century, clearly reject the idea of any special treatment for any one province. And any attempt to do that is going to lead to repudiation, as we saw with the Charlottetown vote, and indeed as we saw even in the Quebec referendum of 1995, as narrow as the outcome of that was, it demonstrated that Quebec still recognizes that it is a Canadian province, part of a great country.
Should Paul Martin then, do you think in the book you say that the single greatest threat to Confederation is Western alienation. Awkwardly put, is the answer therefore to do as you suggest in the end of the book, the co-capital idea? Is that something
this is a concept that I brought forth as a result of looking at the role of the Western protest movements in many elections over the past many years. And you know, whether it was the Progressive Party that arose on the prairies in the 1920s, Social Credit, CCF, the Reform Party, all of these parties had a common characteristic, and that was that they were alienated by Ottawa's policies toward the West. They were not anti-Confederation. They were not against federalism as a concept, as the way under which we should conduct our government. What they were upset with and distressed with were what they viewed as discriminatory policies that were economically damaging to people in the West. And I've recommended in Turning Points that one of the things we need to do is bring the federal government more into a closer relationship with people across the country. Now, some of that is now being done. Some federal government offices, the GST, for example, is being administered from Prince Edward Island. Important aspects of the Department of Immigration are managed out of an office in Alberta. So what I would like to see happen is I would like to see us designate a second city in Canada where we could also have sittings of Parliament, where the Supreme Court could hold hearings. And I believe by doing that, I think it would change the political culture of the country, bring Ottawa much more closely to the average citizen, and most important of all, bring the politicians and the civil servants in Ottawa out of that narrow, small cocoon in which they live, and let them see what the rest of the country is really like. And I do believe that this would be very helpful in raising the level of understanding and appreciation of the decision makers in Ottawa of the needs of the rest of the country.
What do you say to someone who's unconvinced, who's dismissive of the proposal outright? Some of the other arguments against it could be like just the cost of designating another co-capital. And in your book, you suggest Calgary, right?
Well, I do. I don't think the cost would be a major factor. Parliament costs one-third of 1 cent out of every tax dollar. You know, we would not be creating new structures. We would be merely transferring them from one part of the country to another. And yes, there would, of course, be some cost. Ideas are easy to challenge, and new ideas can be easily rejected. But I think I think something like this should be examined, because I think that it's better to look for ways to overcome divisions than merely to repeat our resentments and our disaffection through complaints and bitching. Let's try and do something about this rather than just continually harp and complain that Ottawa doesn't understand us.
In the book, you note that Holland has two capitals and South Africa has three capitals, so it could work. What's the reaction been when you take this book across the country to your ideas about co-capitals?
I've had a very, very strong, a very favorable reaction from almost everyone that I've spoken with, all in the sense that, for instance, Dr. Gibbons, who heads the Canada West Foundation, said this is the kind of out-of-the-box thinking that we need. He said debate about the future of the West in Canada has been constrained by old ideas. We need new ideas, and Turning Points makes a great contribution, in his words, to this discussion. So I'm very much encouraged by that response. I'm also encouraged on a broader level by the general reaction of the educational community to the book, you know, because Canadian history has a bad rap. It's viewed as dull. It's not adequately taught in the schools. But I've just today received from the Peel Board of Education in Ontario, one of the largest school boards in Canada, an excellent rating for Turning Points, with an evaluation that this is an excellent resource and that it's very readable. Right. And they go on to suggest four courses in which the book should be used as a teaching aid in the schools. So I'm very encouraged by that.
Congratulations on that point. Yeah, I must say that it is quite readable, and for example, the 1866 New Brunswick campaign, I knew very little about that. And reading the book actually put it all in perspective. And it was easy to read, and I guess it's the journalism background that allows you to make it so lively. And
well, I hope that. I hope that's the case. I've tried to be a good reporter, an observant and fair reporter, I hope that I've been able to do that.
I've always thought that journalists who write books about history are far more readable than historians. For example, Bob Woodward's books are absolutely, bar none, far more readable than, let's say, something written by Michael Beschloss or Doris Prince Goodwin.
Well, indeed, and of course, Bob Woodward is a man who's not only lived history, but made it himself.
Right. And let's get back to the proposal for co-capital is rather extraordinary. You suggest greater public input in selecting senators, governors, general, and Supreme Court justices, and that's something that we've seen a little bit of movement on, especially with this new regime. How do you think you can further public input in selecting those
well, I
people
think
for
by,
those positions?
Yes, again, what I like to try to do is take these, look at trends, and assess where we can take these trends. For example, I've said that There is a move afoot to distribute some of the federal offices throughout the country. So I've taken that development and carried it through to an ultimate end of a second national capital in the West. Similarly, on these other issues, election of senators, proportional representation, I believe we need to carry that trend through. In terms of the offices, both of the Senate and the Governor General, my view is that if we're going to have these offices, they belong to the people, and the people should decide who is going to fill them. And of course, none of this would require any change to the Constitution, because under the present system, the Prime Minister decides who shall sit in the Senate, and he recommends to the Queen who should be Governor General. He could continue to do that on the basis of being accepting the judgment of the Canadian people in a freely expressed election as to whom they would like to have fill those offices. Similarly, I think on the matter of proportional representation, notwithstanding the problems that are arising now with minority government, I do believe that we need to look at proportional representation and implement some type of program that would ensure that the smaller parties have a better voice in Parliament.
Are you one of I've wondered this in reading the book. Are you one of those liberals in exile, like Warren Kinsella, or are you part of the party, or are you?
Well, I consider myself a citizen and a journalist first, a party member second. I'm very comfortable with the general position of the Liberal Party. Certainly the history of the Liberal Party in this country is one that I think in which we can take great pride. I'm not entirely happy with the way the party's being currently administered or with the present leadership, but that's not something I lose any sleep over.
I ask that, one, because I wondered reading the book, and second, do you think that Paul Martin will listen to the provinces? Because we have a number of Senate vacancies, and we've got, I think, one in this province, and then there's I believe, three in Alberta, or two or three.
Yes.
And then there are some more in throughout the country. How do you think he'll address those? Will he listen to provincial governments? Will elections be held? Or?
So far, Mr. Martin has shown a great disinclination to address really a number of the issues that he's faced with. And Senate appointments are one of them. So it's very difficult to forecast, except that I think he will make a judgment based on his perception of how this will affect the party in the next election.
I see. Ray, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on this book. It is actually quite readable and quite engrossing.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
Thank you. The book is called Turning Points, The Campaigns That Changed Canada 2004 and Before, from White Knight Publications, and the author is Ray Argyle. The website for the book is www.turningpoints.com.